I want to begin with a disclaimer. I am now taking a presentation that really should be 2 hours that was previously condensed into 1 hour. I'm squeezing it further into half an hour. My only window has an effort is that I've prepared all the slides for you and given them out to you, so I'm hoping if this is a topic that's of interest to you, you'll be able to take the time to read things through a little more carefully at a pace that's appropriate for you. But again, I really sort of want to apologize in advance because of the time. I get to go until 12:30. Is that correct, or tell me?
Yes.
Okay, good, wonderful. Okay, another important disclaimer, that is, some of you may be wondering, maybe not, you know, with respect, that was a very nice bio, thank you very much, Rabbi Beth Aaron of Camp Morishah, et cetera, et cetera. I have no clinical experience or degree or qualifications to speak about the topic of eating disorders from a medical, clinical perspective. At the same time, you know, and you could take it or leave it, you know, because of my own personal experience with a member of my family and, I guess, sort of by extension, a lot of informal professional experience and just interpersonal experience in trying to help other people throughout the community, and I mean the global community. So I've had a lot of experience, and therefore I sort of feel like I'm entitled to give such a lecture. But of course, it goes without saying, should you have any important questions that require professional counseling or direction, you're always welcome to consult with me, and what I probably do is tell you, you know, the best person to speak to locally or, if necessary, out of the community. But please understand that there's no doctor before my name. So I'd like to speak about eating disorders in the Jewish community, detection, prevention, and treatment. I think the official title this morning, what every parent and educator needs to know. Of course, parents parent their children and raise their children and hope that under the best of circumstances, there'll be few, if any, serious concerns along the way, certainly health concerns. And of course, I hope that everyone here can say that. The same is true for teachers. However, we see that across the community, the Jewish community in particular, eating disorders are a constant area of concern. And I believe that there are specific areas which we, as Jewish parents and educators, can focus on to help if not completely inoculate and immunize our community, but at least be more prepared to detect, which is perhaps most important, then prevent, and if necessary, treat. So first question is, what is disordered eating? We're speaking about eating disorders, so what exactly is disordered eating? So I thought that it would make more sense to talk about what is normal eating, because rather than focus on a disorder, let's just reflect for a moment what normal eating means. So normal eating satisfies a physiological need. Right, we're hungry and we eat. Appetite is regulated without conscious input. This doesn't mean that every once in a while a person who's not eating disorder will look at the watch and say, oh, it's lunchtime, I probably should eat now. But generally speaking, I don't have to remind myself to eat or to stop eating. Eating is controlled by hunger, appetite, and satisfaction. These are normal automatic functions which the body is prepared to sort of take over and does not require any conscious oversight on our part. Personal taste plays a moderate role in food selection. Eating is pleasurable. Of course, there's a beautiful display out in front. If you like tuna, you take tuna. If you prefer cream cheese, you take cream cheese. Most of this, again, is happening without much conscious input, hopefully anyway, and even if it's not. Normally speaking, taste plays a moderate role, which I guess means that if there's nothing good to eat, you still will eat. And if there's a selection, you'll choose that which you prefer. Sensible choices help regulate portion control and nutritional intake. Of course, people try to be smart. We're all very health conscious, and we follow the news and trends and learn about certain staples in one's diet that are important. And more or less, all of us have some basic knowledge about the basics of nutrition. And this factors into our eating experience. And finally, normal eating accommodates temporary shifts in schedule, needs, or environment. This is why we can eat a lot on Shabbos, and maybe feel a little bloated afterwards, but it doesn't necessarily mean that on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday we're going to do the same. It also means we can come into a fast day, such as Yom Kippur, go a full 25 hours without eating, and recover pretty quickly because our body is prepared, especially when we're already nutritionally sound, to be able to handle these sorts of disruptions. And here you have sort of an illustration of the normal, healthy eating cycle. I'm going to skip the slide entirely, but basically, as you see, there are hormonal explanations for pretty much everything that was just discussed.
this is not just magic, but a normal healthy body is, you know, is rigged to be able to allow for normal healthy eating. Disordered eating is essentially the flip side, the mirror image of that. Over here, eating or restricting satisfies a psychological or emotional need. Now a person is thinking way too much about what they're eating or about what they're not eating. Appetite is regulated with conscious input. A person may feel hungry but would say, wait a second, I just ate 12 hours ago. I shouldn't be eating it again. Or the other way around, you know, I just finished 2 hours ago, I'm hungry. Eating is controlled by will, planned diet. The body takes over that which is normally an automatic process. Eating is not necessarily pleasurable. The research on this is somewhat inconclusive as to whether or not a person who is, obviously it won't apply to anyone in this, everyone in this population, but many eating disordered individuals claim that they do not find eating pleasurable at all. It's a question whether or not, you know, that's just, you know, some sort of psychological experience, or maybe in fact that part of the of one's, you know, normal function is not functioning properly. Portion control and nutritional intake become severely compromised, and here you have a very different type of illustration as to what exactly it looks like in the mind and the heart and the soul of an individual who is eating disordered. Suddenly, a healthy cycle of appetite and followed by, you know, eating and satisfaction and hunger is now taken over by a completely different experience and a completely different set of thoughts, which is, of course, very concerning. The brain sort of turns on itself, and the natural instincts for survival becomes compromised. One of those amazing things about our bodies is that a normal, healthy human being is rigged for survival with or without our conscious input. So if we're, you know, running very quickly, so body secretes adrenaline to the body, and our heart starts pumping more, and the body is constantly accommodating and adjusting to external and internal factors. An eating disorder is quite alarming in the sense that the body is essentially turning on itself. Eating disorders are not to be confused with, this is perhaps one of the most important slides, picky eating, unhealthy dieting, and overindulgence. Hope you enjoy your not the picture. Sorry, but you know, you got it. These are very common features that we all have in our family, extended family, among friends and colleagues. From time to time, we ourselves may manifest these behaviors or these experiences, and it's very, very important. My primary objective this morning is to sort of sound an alarm, make sure that people know what to be prepared for, what to be on the lookout for. At the same time, it would be responsible for me, and I will have failed if everybody walks out of there thinking that, everybody that I know is eating disordered, because many of the people who know can actually fall into any one of these three categories, but that's not so. Picky eating, a lot of picky eaters. There is a condition known as selective eating, and some actually do believe that that is a form of an eating disorder. There are technical criteria which need to be met, which we're going to get into right now. Unhealthy dieting. So as somebody that I know very, very well, who's recovered from an eating disorder, has pointed out to me on several occasions, many, if not most, of her peers and friends, and that extends, I would say, the entire local Jewish community, but I'm sure it could be, you know, applied beyond as well, are guilty of some form of unhealthy dieting. We are certainly not labeling that entire population as being eating disorder, although it is a concern, and of course there are overlapping circles at times. And overindulgence, which of course is a major problem within the Jewish community, not exclusively, but we have our own reasons why. I never noticed that before. Cheeseburgers, of course, that wouldn't apply to our community, but I can't believe I never noticed that. That's an example of an unhealthy habit, which is not necessarily a sign of an eating disorder. Eating disorders are very serious business. Over 11 million Americans suffer from eating disorders. They have the highest mortality of any mental illness. It's a really disturbing but fascinating feature of this illness. Actually, no other mental illness is technically fatal. It's true that extreme depression can lead to suicide, but it's not the depression that kills a person. An eating disorder can be fatal and does kill people in the short term and sometimes in the long term. The long-term effects of sustained malnutrition can shave years or decades of a person's life. Anorexia is the third most chronic illness among adolescents. We know that this is a disease which is more common among adolescents. 95% of those who have eating disorders between the ages of 12 and 25, so the younger population is certainly most at risk. 20% of those suffering from anorexia will die prematurely from complications due to their eating disorder. Once again, prematurely doesn't mean that they will die between the ages of 12 and 25, but you know, some of them will have lifelong ramifications because of the sustained malnutrition. And it's relevant to this discussion that the cost can be very, very expensive. And as costs of healthcare in general have risen in this country, it's become more and more difficult to properly treat eating disorders. Rates of recovery, this is, I don't know if this is an official statistic, but this is what a lot of people say, a third recover after initial episode, a third fluctuate, recovering relapse, and a third suffer chronic deterioration. I can only tell you anecdotally, as I've been very immersed in the sugya for over 5 years, in my experience, within the Jewish community, and you know, perhaps even more so the Orthodox community, but I don't know that it's unique to our community, but in communities in which children come from families that are very supportive and communities that are supportive, even if it's, you know, too late, but by the time they figure out what they need to do. So I think the statistics of recovery are much higher than this. It is true that there are no guarantees, and unfortunately there are sometimes some real tragic, you know, endings to these stories, but, you know, this would lead you to believe that two-thirds of those who suffer from eating disorder are going to suffer on some level for the rest of their life, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily, you know, reflective of our community. I'm really going to try not to spend a lot of time on details of anorexia or bulimia, but these are singled out on my slides because they're the two most common forms of eating disorder. Anorexia is where an individual has a distorted body image and an irrational fear of becoming overweight. So he or she deliberately attempts to lose weight through restriction and other forms of calorie burning and purging. It takes a little while to process that, but there are several features to anorexia all outlined over there. Malnourishment in a person who suffers with anorexia can lead to many very serious and concerning physiological complications. I'm not going to read down the list, but you can see it for yourself. I don't have to tell you, these are a great concern, and they're not all on the same level. I have heard, once again, from feelers that I have on the ground, you know, I have close to me three teenage daughters, my friends, and, you know, you hear that it is not uncommon at all for girls in, you know, high schools, our own high schools, local and beyond, to brag to one another that they have stopped menstruating. They are not aware of the fact that they're really sort of playing with fire. Now, to stop menstruating for a period of time in of itself is not necessarily so concerning. But what that means, implications for a person who is, you know, really, you know, playing with their body in a way that the body is basically saying, listen, I'm not ready to reproduce, so that's a very, very healthy way of living. You go down the list, and they're far more concerning. Cardiac complications. I have met several teenagers who are, if not even their 20, who have had multiple heart attacks in their life, and these are people who are born with completely healthy hearts. And there are reasons as to why cardiac complications are common in people with sustained malnutrition. Again, not for the moment, but just understand that this is very, very, very serious business. What are some symptoms? So there'll be several areas. Food behaviors, signs and symptoms is a person who is dieting despite being thin. This, again, is a feature that we see in our community, even among those who are not eating disordered. But this is something which is a sign, a symptom of someone who is. So if you know somebody who diets despite being thin, please, that doesn't mean that they have an eating disorder. But this is a common symptom among one who does. Obsession with calories, fat, grams, and nutrition. Having a person who's focusing again and again on the labels on the side of food products. Pretending to eat or lying about eating. Preoccupation with food, constantly thinking about food. Interestingly, cooking for others. You would think that a person who's eating disorder doesn't want to touch food, but actually sometimes we see the reverse, that they feel a great degree of control of their own ability to restrict, but by helping serve others and prepare for others. And they said, look at you. You can't stop, and I can. So this is, again, one of the symptoms we sometimes see. Strange or secretive food rituals, refusing to eat around others, cutting food in a certain way. These are classic symptoms which would point to a person who is anorexic. It should be obvious in light of my first disclaimer. I just want to repeat right now, no one should ever self-diagnose or diagnose anyone else with an eating disorder. So if you suspect, that there's someone you know, if you're in a position to do something about that, the first thing you would want to do is either impose, if you're talking about someone who's, you know, a child of yours, or encourage, using means that we'll discuss later, that this person gets professional help. And then, you know, a professional diagnosis can be made whether or not the person is at risk of becoming eating disordered or actually is already. Other symptoms include anorexic appearance, body image signs. Okay, so dramatic weight loss, feeling fat despite being underweight, fixation on body image, harshly critical of appearance, denial of thinness. These are all common features among people who are anorexic. And if you've ever interacted with someone who is eating disordered, or if you yourself have ever struggled with it, you know how profound some of these symptoms can be and how frustrating they can be. When you look at somebody, you say, what are you talking about? You're thin. Look, I can take my hand and I can wrap it around your whole wrist. And they say no. And I'm sure you've all seen the pictures of a person standing in front of a mirror, really like an emaciated frame, but you know, the mirror tells them, their eyes perceive a very, very different story. This is not just a person who needs to grow up, and this is not just a bunch of mishigas. Like many other psychiatric conditions, you have a person over here who is literally, you know, seeing things that that aren't true. Denial of thinness. You cannot convince somebody who is convinced that they are thin that they are that they are fat that they're not. Bulimia nervosa. Over here, the individual experiences regular bouts of serious overeating, which are always followed by a feeling of guilt, which can then lead to extreme reactions such as crash dieting, doing lots of exercise, and purging. So there are some overlapping features, but what makes bulimia most different is that whereas the anorexic person typically does not overeat at all, restricts at different levels of restriction, the bulimic person will go through periods of overeating. And actually, you know, to a person who had no experience whatsoever, you may think that this person actually is better off because at least, you know, over time, they're getting their nutrition. But the truth of the matter is, this is potentially a much more dangerous situation. Anybody know why?
Is it because the stomach acid, when you purge, I mean, it's ruining your throat.
Right. So Rivka is correct that there are many side effects. Some of them are minor, some are major, as to what can happen, you know, when a person purges again and again. And that is true. That is true. And I'm not going to deny that. However, remember, even an anorectic will sometimes, will often, purge as well. But the reason why the bulimic is potentially at much higher risk is because it's much more difficult to detect. Because you will not necessarily see a person thinning out over time and then disappearing before your eyes. And a person will not necessarily go for long periods of time sleeping and just, you know, showing the signs of a person who's suffering from sustained malnourishment. Sometimes the first people, the first responders, the first detectors of a person's bulimic are the dentist, for the reason that Rivka just mentioned, that they're cleaning someone's teeth and notice that the enamel behind the teeth has been completely worn off, and they put it all together and say, it must be that this person is vomiting a lot. If the parent doesn't know about that, this is no sort of chronic stomach illness, so that usually means only one thing, and that is that the person is vomiting on a regular basis, which usually is a sign of concern. Here you see, going back to similar types of illustrations we saw earlier, the experience of control, anxiety, guilt, and numbness, and redemption, very much interconnected with dieting and hunger and eating, binging and purging, and you know, the sum total of it is a big problem. Some of these symptoms, using diet pills, laxatives, and diuretics. If I had all the time in the world and all the money in the world and nothing else to do, I would, you know, lobby Capitol Hill to. It's very nice that they made it virtually impossible to go ahead and buy Sudafed. I understand there are reasons for that, and call a kavod to them for protecting us and our community from drug dealers. But I can tell you that any child could walk into CVS at any point and buy a whole caseload full of laxatives. There are different types of laxatives. Some of them, which are common, pretty harmless products, if they're used on a regular basis, can cause, once again, irreparable harm to the body. There are, unfortunately, again, it's not necessarily common, but it is not unheard of people who have been eating disordered for several years, who then require, you know, even if they recover from the eating disorder, their colon never recovers because of the damage that was done by the overuse of laxatives. So they are very, very dangerous if they are abused. Throwing up after eating, compulsive exercising. You may not necessarily hear or see a person who's throwing up, but if the person is always disappearing after a meal, 5-10 minutes, and you hear the water running in the bathroom, and they come out looking nice and refreshed with the mint-smelling breath, these are the signs that something may be going on. Unlike anorexia nervosa, as I pointed out already, very difficult to identify. These are some of the signs that may indicate that a person is engaging in regular bouts of purging. Oh, we're running out of time. What causes eating disorders? So as you can probably imagine, if you have any experience with, you know, psychological disorders of any form, so it's a combination. Nobody exactly knows. It's probably a combination of biological, psychological, interpersonal, social. There's a statistically significant number of people with eating disorders who have experienced trauma in their life, but many have not. There are a statistically significant number of people with eating disorders who other people in their family, immediate family or extended family, have had eating disorders, but not necessarily. So you have a whole, you know, potentially whole group of issues. I like the what's called the loaded gun theory, which is, I think, very important. Not just it helps us, you know, understand this, but really helps us prepare ourselves for it. And that is that there are a lot of, we'll say kids, but people, but a lot of kids that are walking around predisposed to eating disorders for a whole variety of reasons. And, you know, call that a loaded gun. And you never know what it will be. And it's not necessarily anything that you or anybody else does, but at a certain point, they may just get pushed over the edge. And then suddenly, they're in control of a full-blown eating disorder, which cannot be traced back to any one of these things. And the reason this is important is because I believe, and I've seen this enough to pretty much feel confident that this is a true statement, that there are parents who can model very, very poorly for the parent, for the children when it comes to eating. They can do all the wrong things. They can say to the kids, you're fat. They can say to the kids, you're why eating so much. And the kids will never become eating disorder. You know, the kids may have other problems, but it's not necessarily going to create, there's no recipe to create an eating disorder child. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are not necessarily such bad role models, but because of the fact that there may be several children in their home that are already predisposed, and they may not even know that, they may be doing things that seem far less sinful than what I just described, but maybe enough to push someone over the edge. When in doubt, refer for help. Don't dismiss what you see, what you hear. Never encourage someone to fix it yourself. Of course, you should never encourage anybody to fix something yourself if it's of serious nature, but that's the kind of thing that we would intuitively sometimes think to say in a situation like this. It's very uncomfortable. I can tell you that my wife and I and one of my children have in particular, she has developed the ability to look at a crowd of 100, 200, 300 people and pick out who's affected. And, you know, it's probably one of the most uncomfortable things in the world. It's usually my wife, and I give her the credit, she's not here to take the credit for it, but it's usually her. But on several occasions, I've gone over to parents and said, listen, you know, take it or leave it, I won't be insulted, but I really, really think that you need professional assistance, and here's why, and here's what I recommend you see. On several occasions, and this is not about you know, patting ourselves on the back, but we've been fortunate to hear back after weeks or months, sometimes longer, that people appreciate that intervention, and one woman insists that my daughter, my wife, saved her life. I think that's an exaggeration, but it really does make a difference. The point is that when you see something to concern, you need to refer. Now, if you don't feel that you are the person to do it, so then you should speak to, and you know, depending on the setting, if it's a school setting, then there are people to go to. If it's a shul, there are people to go to. If it's just friend among friends, and I've sometimes been called by this, sometimes some sort of intervention is necessary. On the other hand, as I said, do not be an alarmist, because sometimes after a session like this, you walk out looking around thinking everybody's eating disorder, but certainly not the case. Yes?
I'm so trained to think of eating disorders with girls. Is there percentage of boys?
I know someone just mentioned that before. I don't know the percentage. Again, it's my own personal experience. I think it's probably somewhere between 10 and 20%. If you look at like inpatient eating disorder facilities, they usually have, you know, room for anywhere from 15 to 25 patients. At any given time, there are probably two boys there. That's not necessarily that's not the way we put together statistics, but I think that's the case. And there are reasons for that, which I hope we'll get to. Treatment of eating disorders. So there are several different health professionals and levels of care, and this, of course, is going to vary depending on the needs of the individual. Eating disorders operate like a vice. When you pull, it pulls back harder. And this is particularly challenging because most people instinctually think that if my child is something, the last thing I want to do is overwhelm them and alarm them and try to pull gently. Often, if you pull gently an eating disorder, it rests on harder. This is not meant as an indictment against any particular pediatrician or pediatrician's bakhlal, but I've made this point before in public, and pediatricians have come over and thanked me and told me, yes, you may say it, that pediatricians are not necessarily equipped to give proper counsel and advice. I'm speaking from personal experience and from hearing from others as well. People who have many, many years, people who are great pediatricians, who really, really know the job well, but this is a specialty. And even pediatricians who are, you know, are on the front line and have to be looking out for so many different types of issues potentially, do not necessarily know that you don't tell a parent with a child with an eating disorder, you know, that you should just not give it too much attention. And by the way, sometimes that may be an appropriate response, but usually not. So if a person is really suffering, they may require a very high level of care. If a person is not, outpatient care, which may be that they'll go to school or work and just, you know, go for treatment a couple times a week. And obviously, sometimes people have to step up and step down depending on the circumstances. There are many different types of treatment modalities that are used for the treatment of eating disorders, but as the case in psychological treatment and counseling in general, the shift seems to be over the past several years to CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. There's a special family-based therapy that's unique to eating disorder, which is called Maudsley, which was originally a hospital in England, called the Maudsley Hospital. And this sort of empowers parents and siblings and other, you know, members of the family to become essentially the caretakers. When this works, this is considered to be the most effective, not necessarily the most proper and holistic, but as well, the most effective form of treating eating disorders. Some of the, I'm not going to mention them by name, but some of the name brand eating disorder treatment centers that perhaps we know of from the past 20 years have sort of, they've fallen off track because they have not been following the evidence-based therapy techniques, and therefore their approach is just simply less effective. Remember, of course, that those struggling with eating disorders often require treatment and maintenance of comorbid psychiatric conditions. It's unusual to find someone with eating disorder who does not have also any one or several of the following, you know, OCD or anxiety disorders, mood disorders, or depression, whatever it is. You get the idea. These are common features that you find. So it becomes particularly complicated when you're trying to, you know, focus on an eating disorder, but at the same time, you have a person who requires treatment for several other things as well. Okay. Assuming that was an act. The other important point to make is that eating disorder treatment is sometimes so complicated because you're trying to treat a person whose brain is perhaps malnourished at that moment. So it can sometimes take many, many weeks or months of just getting the brain malnourished to the point where the person is then available for some form of counseling or treatment. So there was an article in about 5 years ago in the New York Times, which seemed to indicate that Orthodox Jews are at higher risk of eating disorders. So at the time, I had a lot of people forwarding me this article, thought I'd be interested by it. A short time later, many people came forward and said that this article was inconclusive. As you can even tell, by the way, you don't have to read it right now, but the way, you know, this quote-unquote study was put together, you could tell that it was not really done in a scientifically sound way. That being said, it's an important discussion to have. In fact, there are studies that have shown that people who come from religious communities, people who have a spiritual inclination, may be actually better equipped to deal with eating disorders. High levels of spiritual well-being were moderately associated with lower levels of body dissatisfaction, which have no association with disordered eating. So it's not necessarily given that Jews are at higher risk. That being said, in our community, areas for honest consideration, the very high demands and expectations of ourselves and our children, which trigger those who are most vulnerable. This is not necessarily unique to our community, but we are guilty of this on many levels. Highly competitive community, lots of peer pressure. The Shidduch process, not to be confused with the Shidduch crisis, which may be related to, but the Shidduch process, you know, everybody here knows exactly what I'm referring to, but there's a lot of pressure that's placed on women in particular to look a certain way, and that, once again, if a person is already predisposed, that may push someone over the edge. Larger family sizes, less attention to each child. This is not to suggest that people should necessarily have fewer children. That's a complicated question, but the point is we do not kid ourselves. If you have two children at home, it's already challenging enough to manage. If you have 10, it's that much more. And we do ourselves and our children a great disservice if we pretend that larger families produces fewer problems. Centrality of food within our culture and lifestyle, Shabbos and Yom Tov, overindulgence, Kiddush, Smachot, the cookbook craze. I've been told that the Art School of Masorah publications, their number one seller is the cookbooks, not the Shabbos. I guess in all fairness, you have a lot more people in the general population that are buying the cookbooks. But when I was growing up, it was the same menu every single Shabbos. If my mother were here, she wouldn't be insulted to hear it. It was just quite simple. And now, God forbid, you should serve the same salad 2 weeks in a row. You know what's going on. So again, on the one hand, wonderful. Kadosh Baruch Hu has blessed us, but it's not all wonderful. The obsession over food is something which has a very, very concerning impact upon those who are predisposed, and even those who are not eating disorder are walking away with very, very confusing messages about a relationship with food. Stigmatization in the community, of course, is something which is a big problem. It affects all different forms of mental illness, not only mental illness, but primarily mental illness. And again, a person is more likely to try to cover up an eating disorder within the Orthodox community than in the general population. So whether it's true or not that we're at higher risk, I don't know, but these are all areas of concern. These are all potentially, any one of these, certainly when we put them all together, areas that can trigger someone. This is part of a great article. I'm very concerned about the time at the moment. You have it in front of you, so I'm not going to read it, the whole thing. Two quotes, but one in particular: more than one mother has reported the need to ask other women at shul to stop complimenting their anorectic daughters on the weight loss and to stop voicing admiration for the discipline and restraint. Unfortunately, this is not just an apocryphal claim. This happens in every one of our shuls, and it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible, and we all need to work together to make sure this stops. And these are very important quotes to read on your own. Of course, we're talking now about the Jewish community. I want to sensitize you with the 4 minutes I have remaining to some of the questions that come up, the halakhic questions, not necessarily to focus on the answers at the moment, which I won't do, but just to be aware of the types of questions people have, to sensitize you to their needs, and also to sort of underscore how important of an issue this is. Elizabeth, 38, has struggled for many years with eating disorders. After years of treatment, she has successfully refrained from restricted eating for close to 1 year. Her therapist warned that fasting, even for one day, could potentially trigger a relapse. What she should do on Yom Kippur? This is a very common question. It's not a common at all. But when you appreciate for a moment, it just doesn't seem as simple as you would think. After all, symptom-free almost for 1 year, is Yom Kippur. We're talking about a situation where, this is not a quote-unquote minor fast day. What should she do? In my experience, I'll mention off the top of my head Rabbi Mordechai Willig, Rabbi Cohen, two posting that I've consulted with on many occasions. Mordechai Willig, Willig is very, very sensitive, b'chlal, and aware about the nuances of mental illness in general, eating disorders in particular, and is one of many resources of getting a very responsible psalm when it comes to important questions like this. Chaim, 16, has been suffering from anorexia for 2 years. He was recently discharged. After his weight has been completely restored, he has not tolerated any variety. Sometimes kids, they come out of treatment, but they're still eating a very limited selection of foods. Basically, he says he's surviving on supplement bars, which are all chametz. So the question is, what should he do on Pesach? Should his parents try at that moment to try to just get through the week on ship's cakes? Or not, if they could even succeed in doing so. This is a fascinating question, a very common question. Esther, 15, suffers from anorexia and is currently undergoing patient treatment. In an effort to optimize treatment, all meals are prepared on site by trained staff and no outside food may be brought to the facility. By the way, this does not mean to suggest that treatment centers are not accommodating to Jews. They are. But in order for them to do what they need to do, that's the last place they could really start playing around. And in my experience, those treatment centers that are very accommodating to kosher patients do not treat them properly. And there's a correlation between the two because they're just too open-minded about what comes in and what comes out, and that plays into the treatment in a very, very concerning way. So number one, can she eat non-kosher food? At this point in the presentation, I hope that it's clear and obvious the answer is yes. We're talking over here about not just a suffrage, we're talking about over here somebody who's suffering from a choli sheyesh bo sakana. However, and I'm almost done, but if she refuses to eat, may her family lie to her, and they other family members eat, why would that happen? Just imagine the following scenario. You've been telling your daughter for the last 3-4 months that she's eating kosher food. That is part of our upgrading the program to bring the family into that quote-unquote family meals.
and you have to follow the same diet. So just imagine for a moment being faced with the question whether you're going to eat non-kosher food in order to keep a lie going that your daughter should think she's eating kosher food. There's another question, I'm out of time. Please read the sample letter at the end. This is written by a very sensitive individual who is trying to sensitize friends and family members before his daughter made it back to shul, to school after treatment, several pages over here. I think that's the end of the slide.
Well, I'll upload the slide from the report.
I'm sorry?
Well, I'll upload the slide.
Oh, thank you very much. I just want to say I'm not, you know, it's all going on the same website, so thank you very much for facilitating this, but if you want to hear a longer version of the presentation, there's an hour-long version that's already in Y.N. Torah with probably a very similar slideshow, so at least you'll hear a little more and maybe hear some questions as well that we probably have any other time. I'm sort of out of time. I'm not running anyway. If anybody has any questions, feel free to reach out to me anytime if you'd like to discuss it further.